Now let's stay at UCLA and catch up with another cosmic process, the nuclear fusion that happens in the sun. That's where small atoms, such as hydrogen, fuse, releasing energy. You know, we've had lots of really political debate in Australia about power based on nuclear fission, where big atoms such as uranium split, releasing energy. But the kind the sun performs, keeping us alive, is fusion. And Troy Carter tells me they have one of the largest experiments in the world, a tokamak, trying to contain it. You were saying just down the road you've got the biggest tokamak, in other words, fusion reactor in the world, is it?
Indeed. We have the electric tokamak, which is by vacuum vessel volume the biggest tokamak in the world until the ITER device is completed.
ITER being in France.
Indeed.
Are you rivals with that one, with Europe?
No. We try to work together. We have collaborations with Europe. We have contributed to ITER diagnostic development, for example. We're all working towards a common cause.
And your device here, does it have more energy yielded than it has put in?
Indeed not. We are mostly studying the physics of the plasma that is confined in these devices. So we do put in fusion fuel. Deuterium will fuse. We've made some neutrons in there, but our goal is not to actually get break-even or net energy gated in this device, just to understand confinement physics.
And confining, yeah, keeping that amazing reaction under control. It's like bottling the sun.
Indeed. It's quite a challenge. High temperature gas, we call plasma, confining it with magnetic fields is very challenging. It does not like to sit still. It can be very unstable. We have to find ways to control those instabilities and make it sit still for long enough to make fusion work.
And what's the news these days about how you're getting on?
Well, there's been quite a bit of news about a couple different ways that we approach fusion. So magnetically confined, so using very strong magnetic fields, but also using lasers to implode fusion fuel. And there's been news on both fronts. The NIF device in Livermore basically broke even and had net energy gain. In the UK, we have the JET device that broke energy records in recent shots with DT.
And what about ITER, that vast construction going up in Europe over years?
So the world has come together on this very large project trying to push forward the magnetic confinement concept. That device has been making great progress in terms of construction. It's been more of a project in management and politics than in physics to this point. You know, the construction is on progress. There's been some setbacks, some delays that are coming, but it's been a great benefit to all the countries involved to learn how to build such a device, to figure out issues on the scale of a fusion power plant.
And one day, you know what's coming next.
Yeah.
One day you'll stand up and say, hey, look, we've done it.
Right.
And when there is a practical device that can be replicated to give us fusion power, when all of those energy questions will suddenly be over, will I still be alive?
We hope so. I'll say this. I helped lead a process for Department of Energy for strategic planning just a few years ago. And you made the case then we're ready for moving forward to develop energy and deploy fusion. And, you know, in that report, we said we hope by the 2040s we can have a pilot plant basically ready to go. Since then, there's been a lot of progress, and in particular, technology breakthroughs that have potentially lowered the bar to getting to where we need to go. One of the issues that had led to the ITER device is, I mean, basically, ITER has to be tremendous and very costly. It's probably a $50 billion device just because of the technology that was available for the magnets and other things. Recent breakthroughs have come. We've seen high-temperature superconducting magnets that can go up to 20 Tesla. This is an amazing achievement that came out of a private company, it turns out, working with MIT. And that really shrinks the scale. It makes it a lot easier to test things. We thought the next step had to be ITER. $50 billion international venture. We may be able to get there at, you know, a tenth of that cost, much less than a tenth of that cost. So this is a huge step forward. You know, people are thinking now that we can actually get to fusion in 10 years. They've got their work cut out for them, but I'm working with them on it. Yeah.
And here on campus, apart from having the biggest device, you also have Fusion Day. What's that?
Yeah, well, Fusion Day is an event that actually is nationwide in the U.S. We descend on Capitol Hill to advocate for funding for fusion and plasma science in general, bringing lots of students. There's a lot of interest in fusion these days. We get a lot of applications from students that want to work on fusion energy, and they're very eager to tell everybody why they want to work on fusion. And this is, we bring them, talk to staffers and representatives on the Hill to advocate for fusion funding.
And you get students here by the hundreds?
Well, in terms of graduate students, right now we're looking at applications. We have about 100 applicants that want to do fusion or fusion-related work to this department right now. And broader than graduate students, you look at undergraduates. I don't have a number to give you, but there's a lot of interest.
So what you're describing really is around the world, all this is going on, as it has done, because the promise is so fantastic.
Yeah.
We'll pretend we're making a sun we can put in a bottle and get energy out more than we put energy in. And it seems on the face of it that there are all these different systems. Are they synergistic? Do they complement each other so that you all arrive at the same place doing well and you share?
Yeah, we're in a new era now where there's a lot of private investment. So it's over $6.5 billion, close to $7 billion has gone into private ventures now. And so there the sharing is a little more constrained. But the problems that remain to be solved, and a lot of them, I mean, there's problems on plasma science and confining the plasma either with lasers or magnetic fields. But a lot of the issues are materials related and breeding fuel. We need tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, as one of the fuel components. Those challenges everybody needs to solve. And the public sector is working. So I think there's going to be a lot of working together on technical issues. And I'm hoping we're all rowing in the same direction together to make this happen.
So you're using lasers as well, are you?
Well, I personally use lasers for other things than compressing fusion fuel. But my colleagues work on inertial confinement fusion. UCLA is now part of an inertial confinement hub. They just launched these, and I'll be participating in some way. But my colleague Derek Schaefer and Chris Neiman are leading the way. Those guys have big lasers, some of them down in our building in the STRB, and work on the NIF device, for example, and other devices like it.
And how powerful are these lasers?
Well, I mean, the ones that we have is one of the most energetic lasers at a university. It's a kilojoule class laser. But the ones at NIF are some of the biggest in the world. Those are up to 2 megajoules or over of laser energy. And that's what was used to get this ignition result.
I imagine a laser is a very, very narrow beam of light. Mm. How is that keeping a bottled sun under control?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, what they do is they take 192 of these lasers and shine them on a target with the idea that you want to use the lasers to compress the target, that you compress to fusion temperature and pressure, basically. And so you hope you get it compressed in the right way, and then it's basically going to explode because the fusion reactions will take off. That's the scheme that they're trying.
And your particular line, how different?
Well, my focus is really on the magnetic confinement side. So what we're trying to do is use strong magnetic fields to make a plasma sit still and behave for long enough to get fusion to occur at an appreciable amount. So you have to hold it at the right temperature, the right density, so fusion reactions can occur. This is actually hotter than the core of the sun is what we're targeting to get good fusion, a lot less dense than the core of the sun. But the trick is getting it to sit still and behave for long enough to get fusion out of it.
And how hot is the center of the sun?
So the center of the sun is around 10 million degrees Kelvin. So we're trying to get to 100 million. We do it. We get 100 million degrees all the time in the laboratory. We've gotten 500 million degrees in the laboratory before. We can definitely get to the conditions. We can get to the temperature, the density. The issue has been just holding it there long enough and stably so we can get the reaction to happen.
But it's still in a container. I'm amazed that your container doesn't melt and the laboratory doesn't melt.
Yes, yes. Well, indeed, this is actually one of the big challenges. So we've made a lot of progress in the plasma physics of confining these things with strong magnetic fields, a lot of understanding. But now the issue is the interface with the outside world. And so, you know, there are materials that we use now that do survive. But the issue is, as we go to the power plant scale, the plasma that is in that device has a lot of energy that comes out and hits the wall, which it does because it doesn't behave well all the time. You worry about melting structures. The other issue is when the fusion reactions happen, they generate energetic neutrons that come flying out. They're not confined by the magnetic field, and those can tear apart your materials. And coming up with materials that can withstand this extreme environment is a challenge that we face right now in making it commercially practical.
My final question about the public. They're nervous enough about fission in Australia. Right. You can't do fission, which is the splitting thereof. The fusion, from what you've described, are people going to be equally nervous? Not in my backyard?
They should not be equally nervous. So fusion has a lot of safety advantages. It does have safety issues that I'll talk about, but it doesn't have the runaway issue that fission does. So fission, we know it works well, right? But the idea for a fission plant is you pile a couple of years worth of fuel in one spot and burn it slowly. And the issue is that fuel can take off on its own and burn all at once. And that's the issue that most people are worried about. In fusion, we can barely keep the thing going. So we can only barely drill dribble in the fuel. So there's no chance of a runaway. It can fizzle and go out. There are safety issues around the fuel. So tritium is radioactive. It's radioactive hydrogen, but that's something we know how to deal with. The other issue is the neutrons that come out of this reaction can activate materials around them. So in other words, it can turn them into radioactive materials. But there we have a choice about what we put around the device. And so you can try to develop materials that are low activation, that behave more like medical radioactive waste from producing isotopes for medicine, rather than the very long-lived, relatively nasty stuff that comes out of fission that you have to have because that's what the uranium splits into. So it is a very different safety profile and much, much safer than fission.
I'll see you in 10 years?
Absolutely, yes. Hopefully sooner when we have big news to announce, but yes, you can.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
The Eternal Promise of Fusion. Troy Carter is director of the Plasma Science and Technology Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles.